And I'm just delighted to introduce you to a man who's been a source of great inspiration, mentorship, and just catalytic fire for me. His name is Andrew Harvey, and he's one of the world's most renowned mystical scholars. He was at the age of 21, received England's highest academic honor to be awarded a fellowship at All Souls College, and he was on a trajectory of high academic distinction and went more on a spiritual quest, and out of that has written book after book that's really pioneered new approaches to mysticism that's integrating threads from the East, from Sufism, from Christianity, and really going into the heart of the divine feminine as well. And in today's call, we're going to talk more about the sacred masculine and how it bears upon the task of sacred activism for our day. So, Andrew Harvey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Stephen. What a delight.
Well, let's begin with, since you're in many ways known better for your reclamation and champion of the sacred feminine, but I'm wondering if you can expound on what do you see as the sacred masculine? What is its highest purpose in this time?
I think the return of the sacred feminine that has been one of the great mystical facts of the last 30 years is also potentially the reinvigoration of authentic sacred masculinity, because for me, authentic sacred masculinity is in a relationship of profound love, worship, adoration, and protection of the divine feminine. So I do not see the masculine as separate from the feminine, but I see that the authentic role of the sacred masculine is to, out of profound love of the feminine, to be the guardian, nurturer, warrior, lover, protector of the feminine in all of its forms. This is, of course, a very radical vision, because one of the paradoxes of patriarchy, which seems to privilege men over women and certainly gives men much more power, is that patriarchy actually creates a horrific internal concentration camp for men in which they are taught to value power over love, in scientific objectivity over intuitiveness, the mind over the body and the heart, and so live frequently very starved, robotic lives. The return of the feminine with its powers of passion and vitality and sacred connection with all things is simultaneously a reactivation of the depths of what the masculine is for, and potentially a way out of this patriarchal nightmare that is now destroying the planet. Without a whole loving army of sacred masculine men turning up, we are finished. And I think this is probably one of the great reasons why Jesus came as a man. It's often said, you know, that Jesus came as a man because men are superior and all of that rubbish, which is what the churches have been saying forever. I think Jesus came as a man because he knew that the prevailing vision of patriarchy would create a group of near-psychopathic, robotic, hard-hearted men that would potentially be masters of a death machine that could destroy the planet. So coming as a man who was infused on every level with the most intense passion for the sacred feminine, while retaining the qualities that are associated with the masculine, of fearlessness, of courage, of standing up for justice in all situations, of risking his life again and again and again to mock and deride the kinds of false spirituality that were infecting his time, and really place his whole life as a sacrifice for the sacred marriage. This is really a sign to all of us, amongst other great male figures such as himself and the Prophet and Rumi, of what a sacred man can be and must be now.
It's a beautiful, eloquent description. And I want to key in on a word you use, or on sacrifice. And so often that In the last era, there's this notion of sacrifice often became an ideal for men in a way that led them to be cannon fodder, if you will, larger causes, whether that's country or battle or kingdom or team. And so sometimes there's a resistance to the notion of sacrifice as something important for the new man, if you will. So just a bit more about that.
Well, I think that the kind of sacrifice I'm talking about isn't being a cannon fodder, being part of this death machine, serving it. I think what I mean by sacrifice is really the power and the passion to lay your whole life in the service of the preservation of the earth, in the service of the preservation of the environment, in the service of the preservation of justice. One of the most profound challenges for all men now, from the awakening of the sacred masculine, is to find the guts to stand up in a time like this for the very kinds of transformation and change that have to happen fast for the world to have a chance now of surviving. Wherever I go, I meet very cowed men, men who are very distanced from their hearts, very distanced from their bodies, who have been brutalized subtly by being slaves of a corporate system, and who are stuck in the narcissism that prevails in our culture that really enforces a kind of constant competitiveness and hunger for status and fame and power, even on decent men, so that they cannot really be the kind of loving, brave, fearless, courageous warriors that are needed for this great transformation. And I think that the reawakening of the authentic sacred masculine is now even more crucial than the reawakening of the sacred feminine. So much work has been done on the sacred feminine, and women have come so far in reclaiming their ancient chthonic roots and powers, and yet the majority of men I meet seem stuck either in macho archetypes or in a slavish adherence to this ghastly corporate culture that we've created, which really robs them of any sacred juice or sacred passion or sacred fearlessness.
It's quite a challenging situation, and I'm wondering, what have you found that really is helpful for men to awaken that sacred fire and to consecrate the warrior energy in themselves to a higher good?
Well, I'd like to talk archetypally, and I'd like to talk about a sacred marriage that I think is the key to awakening the sacred masculine, and that is the sacred marriage between the archetype of the green man and that of the black Madonna. And I think this is a very powerful way of constellating the forces that are now needed to transform the planet, without which the planet will die. The green man is an ancient pagan symbol of a being that has become one with plant life, one with the trees, one with nature. And it's a very powerful symbol of a chthonic, erotic, powerful, passionate masculine. It's also very powerful because green is the color of the heart in Sufism and in certain Christian mystics like Hildegard of Bingen. And the green man, because he is grounded in nature, in the trees, in the plants, and grounded in the depths of his heart connection with the whole of creation, and grounded in his own sexual tantric body, is able to embody great energies of passion and joy and fearlessness and intense focus. If you marry that archetype, which strangely enough arose with the reawakening of the divine feminine in the 12th century, the last great period where the awakening of the divine feminine took place, there are 72 representations of the green man, for example, in Chartres, which, of course, as everyone knows, is dedicated to the Great Mother. With the awakening of the divine feminine, this passionate archetype is activated. Now, what is really essential, I believe, is to make quite clear what aspect of the feminine this masculine now needs to mate with inwardly. Of course, the masculine needs to be in touch with the nurturing, protective, tender, loving feminine, but this is the time of the black Madonna, the dark feminine, the furious, outraged mother, who is stamping her feet and who will continue to stamp her feet until we have listened to her and changed our ways of being and doing everything. And the Black Madonna has a particular set of strengths to offer to the warrior, lover, green man, masculine. And there are four strengths that she can offer. First of all, she can offer her transcendent cosmic awareness of the void that births all things, the humbling mystery of a transcendence that can never be seen or exhausted, the dark womb out of which all come. Second is she can offer to the green man the deepest possible understandings of the transforming rhythms of nature that give birth, so that the green man, by allying with her power at the deepest levels of himself, can become a birther of creative projects, a birther of new visions, a birther of radical instigations and passionate calls to justice. She's also profoundly tantric, the Black Madonna, and one of the ways in which patriarchy has enslaved men is that it has turned men into fuckers and not lovers, into molesters and killers by two real ways, by degrading women so that men treat women as objects very often, and also by installing homophobia. So men, gay or straight, are terrified of the kinds of sacred love that should be one of the tremendous cements of sacred masculinity. So the Black Madonna, in this third aspect of the great tantric queen, offers the green man archetype all of the secrets of tantric ecstasy and tantric passion, the very huge energy that is awakened in the cell when, in the cells when a man can make love to another man or another woman with the kinds of ecstatic celebration that the Black Madonna favors. The fourth power that this archetype can give the green man to fuse with his own sacred powers is the power of outrage. One of the difficulties of the masculine archetype of our time is that it stresses so much a kind of pseudo-cool and pseudo-balance and pseudo-control. It absolutely celebrates a control which, while it pays tribute to the heart occasionally, is terrified of the heart's passions and the heart's agonies. And to get in touch with the heart's passions and agonies at this time when nature is being devastated and 2 billion people are living on less than a dollar a day and nothing is being done seriously about environmental collapse and the whole spiritual world is still convulsed by the secret at a moment when so much is at stake, all of the potential devastations, to not to be in touch with them is to be deprived of the sacred fuel of transmuted anger, the fierce compassion energy that is the depth of the Black Madonna, but also the depth of the green man. So if we can allow the return of the divine feminine to activate this chronic, primordial, sensual, wild, gorgeous green man in connection with the deepest powers of nature, and then unite that inside ourselves with the great powers of the Black Madonna, then what we can really start to create is a group of sacred male warriors, lovers, protectors, who will be brave enough to stand up against the corporate craziness, against the spiritual madness, against the terrible degradation of what we're doing.
One thing that I'd love to get your thoughts on, when you speak of activating the sacred warrior and standing up against the corporations or the madness, and there's, I think, one of the reasons for sometimes a softening of that edge is that the creation of polarity, of polarization, or, you know, being anti something can sometimes be perceived as creating more divisions, more barriers between people.
This is a potentially very dangerous softening of a very important part of the sacred masculine. One of the essential powers of the sacred masculine is its fearless denunciation of darkness and destructiveness and evil. And this you can see in Jesus' denunciation of the priests that separate humanity from God. You can see this in the prophets' ferocious denunciations of the powers that subjugate the poor. You can see this in the lives of really all the great masculine figures who have stood up, many of the great masculine figures who stood up for justice. Rumi called Shams a sword soaked in dawn. And Shams was famous in his time for alienating all the fake teachers of his time because he called them on their bullshit. And without that power being there in the sacred masculine, the sacred masculine will simply be an effeminized force. Of course, that power must be wise and it must be discerning and it must be balanced with compassion. But perhaps one of the most essential aspects of the sacred masculine compassion is its potentially harsh passion for truth and its courage in speaking up for that passion, not only on behalf of those who are being destroyed by the systems of cold evil, but on behalf, too, of the people who are actually starving the systems of cold evil, and who in a world like ours, where they run almost everything, hardly ever hear the genuine voice of outraged, ferocious truth. So while I believe that we should respect all beings, part of the truth of spiritual respect can be very deep ferocity, and that may be one of the very greatest gifts of the sacred masculine.
I want to keep exploring with this because it's a very juicy subject. Because part of what I've also seen is that if we idealize that energy a bit, and then there's a way in which there's can be a righteousness that's non-self-reflective or doesn't really look into our own shadows, and that's where we start to shade back into a little more of the old pattern of everybody feeling they're righteous and that the enemy, whether it's the Republicans
that's
or the enemy,
danger.
The Democrats are the enemy, or somehow that we need to vanquish the opponent
rather than that this may be one of the great gifts of the Black Madonna, in that perhaps the fifth power that she offers us is the humbling wisdom of the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
But without that edge being there, we won't be effective, but with that edge being merely wielded by self-righteousness, we won't be effective either. That's why sacred activism is as important as I think it is, because the kind of edge and fierceness that I'm advocating is some that is an edge and fierceness that is actually constantly tempered by shadow knowledge. But it doesn't fall into the very big mistake that I think is being made by a lot of people who have an inadequate vision of shadow knowledge, which is that we don't complain and we don't fight for what we believe is real because we've allowed ourselves to become too overwhelmingly connected to the very dark things that are happening.
That's a very interesting and subtle distinction there.
It's a very important distinction because there's a way in which people use shadow knowledge to say, we don't need to have to protest against what the CEOs are doing. We don't need to have to really, really stand up for against the appalling corruption of Wall Street. We don't have to really hold anyone to accountable because we recognize the things that they're doing inside ourselves and we don't want to create polarities. This allows them to have completely free range. The authentic shadow response is this, I think. It is to recognize that all the things that you're seeing as devastating outside are in yourself, to work deeply on the transmutation of those things into compassion and fierce compassion energy and real commitment to transformation and change, but not to not discern the devastating destructive impact of those things both in yourself and in the world, and not to not stand up to talk both about that destruction in oneself and in the way in which it manifests in social and political and economic structures. And I think that's a crucial distinction.
So we've been talking a little more about the activist side of the equation. So what about, you're also starting to teach on sacred leadership, which implies that it's people within existing structures and organizations, perhaps working for corporations as well, that are called into a deeper kind of leadership. It seems to me that there may be some different insights that apply if people have their calling is to work within those systems as well.
Well, what sort of different insights?
Well, in terms of, I think just how to balance the evolutionary impulse to change and to grow with the stabilizing function that, you know, things can evolve at only so quickly in a way. So it's
you
like,
think that those corporations are a stabilizing function, do you?
No, I think that any organizational system has to maintain a certain homeostasis, and it can grow so quickly. And so when you're in a leadership position within an organization, it might appear very different than from an activist standpoint on the outside.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, of course, but that's partly why we're doing this, is to help leaders become much braver about the kinds of risks they take,
mm-hmm.
and to stop thinking of structures as laid down in stone, and to start seeing the very, very great dangers that are inherent in their ways of thinking and their ways of doing, and to be so infused by spiritual courage and by spiritual practice that they are really prepared not only to rock the boat tremendously, but to be examples of a new kind of creativity and ethical intelligence that will be challenging beyond belief to the whole corporate political economic structure. I'm not interested in the kinds of people who are likely to be attracted to the work that I'm doing are not likely to be the kinds of CEOs who go down for the odd shamanic journey just to feel vaguely connected with nature in between organizing corporations that are destroying nature. That's not what I think I will attract. I think that what I'll attract are the people who are waking up to the horror of the whole mad structure that they are in, who have the guts to stay within it to try and shift it, or at least to try and bring a whole new vision into it, and who are really looking for the kinds of help and support that they will need to be able to do that. I'm working with many people in the corporate world who are absolutely aghast at the way in which corporate life is organized, aghast at the ways in which the structures prevent any serious debate about ethics or about the environment, aghast about the kind of schizophrenia that they themselves feel because they know that what they're being paid for is deeply, deeply unethical very often, and who really still want to try and shift, but not from any of the old positions, but from a new vision which they deeply need to comprehend and incarnate. That's a very brave position, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well said. In a few moments here, we want to take some questions from folks. If you're on the webcast, you can type that into the text box on the side or touch 1 on the Maestro conference line. But also, just before we do that, I'd love for you alluded to it earlier that the special role perhaps that gay men have in helping to evolve our vision of masculinity. And since you're out as a gay man and that you're a prominent spokesperson, I'm just curious what you see as
I'm going straight, Stephen.
You're going straight?
Yes,
oh,
I'm completely renouncing my
own,
of course.
I'm just curious if you could reflect a little on that, because it is sort of such a tension point in our culture.
There can be no sacred masculinity, authentic sacred masculinity, without a complete rubbling of the homophobia that patriarchy specializes in. Patriarchy specializes in separating men from their own hidden feminine and women from their own hidden masculine, so as to keep both sexes in a state of radical disempowerment, which makes them extremely serviceable to this ghastly machine of power. And homophobia is an absolutely stupendously effective way of preventing both gay and straight men, because both gay and straight men have homophobia, to integrate the masculine and feminine within themselves, and so to become uniquely powerful and sensitive and uncontrollable. So the real work of much of what sacred masculine groups should be dealing with, and of course they didn't do this with Robert Bly and whoever it was that went off into the woods and beat drums, is to start to deal with homophobia, the whole horror of male affection, the whole horror of showing emotion, because without that being dealt with, the radical integration of the sacred feminine and masculine within the masculine cannot happen. And I think gay men who have done this, who are doing this integration of masculine and feminine, who are refusing to fit in with the old masculine patterns of control and calm and not rocking the boat and being balanced and stable in that old way that truly serves the patriarchy, because the patriarchy loves to talk about balance and polarities while keeping together the most insane, unjust system, and who are also doing the work of integrating the Black Madonna and all her forms, they are in the vanguard of a movement of sacred masculinity and are a sign and a challenge to other straight men, I think. And a particular, and an invitation too, for straight men to get over being such slaves of a system of power and start taking the very difficult but very holy journey into becoming fearless warriors for the sacred feminine and the preservation of the earth.
Great. Let's get a live call from Harvey. Harvey, you're live.
I'm live.
Hi, Andrew. I met you last year at Ani Kalajian's June 26th meeting.
Oh, yes.
And you revealed heart yoga to me. And it was, it's been absolutely marvelous. I do it every day, at least once a day. And it has really transformed my whole experience of myself and humanity.
Oh, so how did it do that as a man? How as a man did it transform you?
Well, certainly moving from the experience of divinity to humility, and then going into the child and surrendering has been an incredible trip to go through each day.
Yes.
And I just want to thank you so much for that. And also, I had brought up a question at that time, and I still don't have the full answer, but you certainly gave me a wonderful one in telling me about Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary.
Yes, great book.
I've read it at least four times now, and I actually am in contact with Dr. McGilchrist. And he sends his regards to you. He remembers you from Oxford.
Yes, we were similar. We were fellows of All Souls together. Wonderful, brilliant man. Yes.
So again, I want to thank you so much. And you know, you've had a tremendous meaning to my life in the past year and a half since I've met you at the Committee on Spirituality.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Harvey. Will on the webcast says, you talk about having a passion for truth. Many who passionately embrace their cause claim to be fighting for what they believe is truth. So what
right.
is truth? Truth according to whom? Is not everyone's truth unique to their to each one's own uniqueness?
I think that's a wonderful question, and I think that there are perhaps different levels of truth. I feel that in certain ways, there are truths that are unique to each one of us as souls and selves and journeying selves. But I think also that the world crisis is making clear certain very devastating truths to us. And I would really think by now we should accept them as being real and as demanding our deepest attention. The truth that if we continue to create a culture that is hell-bent on dominating and exploiting nature, we will create a crisis which will destroy us. I think that is increasingly clear to many people. What seemed overwrought, as some of my friends said last year, may seem a little less overwrought this year in the face of what's been going on in Japan and in the various manifestations of weather disturbance. And I think that it's also very clear that the world capitalist system that we've created isn't working. It's now in the hands of gangsters. The Wall Street clash was very, very extreme, and the fact that nobody's been in any way held to account for it, and that all parties are in bed with it, with Wall Street, is obvious to anybody with half a brain. I also think that it must be obvious to anyone with half a brain now that any fundamentalist approach to religion is a complete psychological disaster because it leads to psychosis. So there are truths that are emerging from the crisis, which I think we all have to be brave enough to face, and then brave enough to articulate a creative response to, which doesn't necessarily demonize the people who are keeping these systems going, but is extremely clear about the destructiveness of the ways of keeping these systems going.
Mm. Great answer. So, Andrew, half an hour goes really quickly, and you have so much to say, I know, but we are at the end of our time, and I just want to...
Lovely to have done it.
Yeah, I just want to honor you for always your eloquence and I think just your deep penetrating insight into these nuances of how to reclaim the sacred warrior in us and not to subtly distance from it in a way that betrays our highest role in today's global crisis.
I would like to say one more thing, and that
sure.
is on your point about these polarities, because this is a question that you and I have come up against many times. I think the sacred warrior is someone who is very, very aware of his or her own shadow, but is also very, very aware of the lethalness and devastating consequences of that shadow in himself or herself and in the world. So when that warrior fights for what he or she believes, and they must, they have to strike a very, very difficult balance between utterly acknowledging their own responsibility for what they are really deeply and clearly denouncing it, and yet having the courage to go out and denounce it. And this is a new tone. If the old tone, which is self-righteous indignation, didn't work, the new kind of new age tone of just feeling one with everyone and not protesting against what the corporations and the politicians are doing is clearly not working, because it's not creating anything like a galvanized enough movement to deal with the crisis. So what we are trying to engender through the marriage of the Green Man and the Black Madonna is a heartbroken tone, a compassionate tone that is also very fierce. And that is the tone of the authentic sacred warrior, someone who is quite clear about their own responsibility for what's happening, aghast at it, and aghast at the clarity that emerges, and passionate about the solutions that need to transform both the person himself and herself and the society. It's very important not to swing from one excess to another and try and find this difficult, mysterious balance that unites the best of both.
Mm. Beautifully and poetically said, Andrew. Again, just I honor you for your wisdom and your passion and your clarion call for the best in us. So if people, I know your website, andrewharvey.net, I know you have some trainings coming up, perhaps.
Yes, I have.
Want to share about that?
Well, I believe that the crisis is so extreme that we really need to train to become sacred activists, and I've started up this Institute for Sacred Activism, and there's an intensive in October, and it really is a kind of initiation, a three-part initiation into the glory of what's possible, into the darkness of what's here, and into the marriage of the wisdom of the light and the wisdom of the dark to form a new kind of sacred masculine and a new kind of sacred feminine. So if I've inspired you in any way, please do come.